Welcome to Sake Deep Dive, the sake podcast for the beyond beginner. I'm your host, Jim Ryan, joined as always by my friend and co-host, Andrew Russell. How you doing, Andy?
I'm good, Jim. Good to see you. Looking forward to another episode, as usual.
Yes, same here. It's winding down towards the end of the year as we're recording this. When you will be listening to it, this is going to be our New Year episode. So happy New Year to everybody out there. I hope it's been a good holiday for you. And Andrew's neck deep in the brewing season. Hope that's going all right for you, Andrew.
Yeah, I would say this is the peak that we're about to go into. December, yeah. January, at Cambyshee anyway. And then from February, it should actually, believe it or not, start to calm down a little bit. Just the way they make sake here, it's Yamaha-y focused. So the moto take a long time. So we actually stopped making moto at the end of January, if you believe that or not. It sounds very early, but when you consider they take over a month just to make the moto, then you understand where the scheduling comes from. So yeah, it's just knuckle down for the next couple of months and then, believe it or not, start thinking about finishing up and getting a couple of drinks with you maybe, who knows?
Yeah, well, I will be ready. So yeah, and you know, it's really quite good that you happen to be a brewer at Cambyshee, because you can give us some interesting insight into some of the elements of what we're talking about today, given that we are talking about some particular traditional equipment in this episode of Sake Deep Dive. Andy, you want to give us our title, our topic for this episode?
Sure. As usual, that was another fantastic segue, Jim, to at least one part of what we're going to talk about, actually.
Sure.
But yeah, I'm trying to think how we word this. We are talking about sake brewing vessels.
Right. The tanks, the kame, the oke, and the tank, the stuff that we make sake in, which seems kind of esoteric, but it's actually quite an interesting insight, I think, into technological development and commercialization and the things that perhaps often get a little bit overlooked when we talk about sake brewing and its history. Yeah. So, you know, sake brewing has a very long history. We're not going back to the very beginning. We're going to back to the beginning of maybe perhaps what we would recognize as sake today, seishu, once we're getting into the more refined version of this drink. Yeah. So if we want to sort of pin down a starting point, Andy, what do you think is a good place to start with this?
The first thing that we need to talk about, obviously, is earthenware. Like right. You said, we can't go right back to the start, because first and foremost, there's not really many records for that, and the ones that are a bit sketchy, and it's not really relevant either, because, you know, this is a podcast about seishu. So if we take earthenware, a little bit strange, but you actually need to start the conversation talking about wooden instruments or wood making technology. And right. the reason for that is that this kind of woodworking technology, they think, gets introduced to Japan round about the 11th century. So it goes really far back, but it didn't readily develop. You can roughly divide them into two categories. But to get the conversation started, we need to go to our good old friend, Mr. Kanji. He's always there to help us out. So the two types, or the two classifications you normally hear about, are, well, the kanji for them is mageru and musubu. And as you know, Jim, the first one I mentioned there is to bend or to warp. And the second one is to bind. And if you look at Japanese wooden instruments from this period, you know, this is the Muromachi period up until the Sengoku period. So what we're talking, the 13th, 14th and 15th century. They aren't bound. So when you see these instruments, like take a taru or a cask, they aren't bound. They're kind of warped. And what they do is they literally warp the wood around, and that is how they hold all the pieces in place. And that type of technology has a lot of drawbacks. They can't hold an awful lot. So they can't make them in big sizes. And as a result, at this time, specifically the sake brewing industry, is still relying on earthenware. So this is the period really of earthenware vessels. And you'll hear a lot of Japanese words for these. You have, like you just mentioned before, you have kame is probably the one that you're going to hear the most. These are pretty tall earthenware. It's like a big vase. And that is what they used to brew in. You might also hear the term tsubo. And a tsubo and a kame actually look pretty similar. As far as I can tell, the biggest difference is tsubo. The opening at the top, the mouth, is very narrow, whereas kame tend to be very wide open. So the tsubo would be more used for storing things like sake. And these are the two types that they would have been used. Early on in their history, it would have been sue ware. This is a type of pottery that originates in Korea, before that very likely China. And then as you get later into this period, as you start going into the Sengoku period, that's the Warring States period, as it's sometimes referred to, then what you're going to find is more towards things like bizen. And if you ever want to get an idea of the scale of these things, then you can go to Nada, for example, and most of the big breweries that have displays and museums and things that you can walk around, they've usually got one of these kame, and they're usually bizen yaki. So that's the first period then that we're gonna talk about.
Right. I think probably just to sort of to clarify a little bit here, what we're talking about then is the places that are brewing sake in these periods, right? The Muromachi and the Edo period, they're using like essentially local pottery, right? So Andy's talking about bizen because, you know, he's speaking from this Nada perspective, and Okayama, where bizen is made, is quite close. Sue ware is actually a very generalized term. So it's a style of pottery that was basically spread nationwide because it's really quite simple. It's a fairly low fired, stoneware that is unglazed, and so it's a kind of a catch-all term that it spread from Korea into sort of the middle of Japan and then sort of petered out into the edges. But what people are doing is basically they're using what they can, because the technology to make large vessels is really, there's only one choice, and that choice is pottery. And then I think it's fascinating to me that even today in southern Kyushu, there are places that make that ferment their shochu monomi in kame, in very large ceramic tanks that are very, very old, because it's really difficult to get any ceramic tanks now.
Yeah. The reason that I'm specifically focused to this part of Japan, right, is really a lot of the technological advancements in terms of sake brewing anyway, they are all from this part of Japan. So we said at the start of the episode that we were going to look at how these instruments affect the landscape of sake brewing at the time. It's all about soboshu, which is predominantly sake that is made in Buddhist temples. You do have other brewing going on, which is obviously people privately brewing. Certainly all the excavation that has gone on in Kyoto, when they dig up these old sites, you've just got hundreds of holes in the ground. These kame would have been buried in them. And these would have been the two types of people that would have been brewing sake. But the Buddhist temples have the benefit of technology from China. And so you get this great period of development that happens in the sake industry. Things like Bodaimoto, basically the first legitimate method of making yeast starter. You can argue where that fits into sake from a modern perspective, but it is a method of making lactic acid, and therefore it's one of the precursors to modern day moto making. But that happens in Nara. So does things like pasteurization. Pressing techniques develop in Nara, and as a result, you have the most sophisticated sake on the market. they actually have a name for it, and there's one thing that I've missed out, which is both types of rice would be white rice. So this is what they called morohaku, and this is what modern seishu is, in my opinion.
It's this really fascinating sort of parallel. Like if you've listened to any of our past episodes, particularly say the Boraimoto episode, like you know that one technology doesn't happen on its own, right? So the fact that, you know, they developed this method of making more stable sake meant that they had a commercial advantage, that they were producing stuff that sold better, and that sort of started to put momentum into the market. And of course, when that happens, you get an increase in demand, right? And so these transformations sort of build on each other. What happens when you have more demand is you have to brew more, and you have to expand facilities. And like Andy said, you know, had all these massive sort of brews that are just filled with holes in the ground, because, you know, the kame don't stand up on their own. You have to kind of embed them in something. And I think what happens is eventually things start to hit their limit. The market sort of pushes a technological development and transformation. And this is when we start to see the transfer to wood. And I think, and as Andy mentioned, the wood at the time was primarily what we called magemono, as he said. It was bent wood vessels. But there did exist bound wood vessels, yuimono, yuioke, yuitaru. And I think this is something that people start to see, as sort of Andy mentioned, into that sort of Muromachi period.
Yeah, we have to remember that when you talk about the Muromachi period, this is the Ashikaga shoguns. They have about two shoguns out of that whole lineage that were actually quite strong and had a good grip over their domain. After that, it starts to unravel quite quickly, and the country is in no way unified. So to have that development on a national scale does not happen. And ironically, as I said, it's the Sengoku period where these daimyo, these regional warlords, stop looking to Kyoto and stop recognizing the authority and start developing their own domains from an economic perspective, that you start to see this great leap in technology.
Yeah, it's just this really complex thing. You know, we look at sake, we focus on this one very specific thing, but of course nothing exists in a vacuum, and all of these sort of socio-political things and you know, one of the things that I keep being reminded of when I'm researching this is Japan looks really quite small, particularly from an American perspective, but it's not. You know, it's a long way from Kyushu to Kyoto if you're traveling by foot and boat and the occasional ox cart or horse. It takes a long time, and so that puts a significant barrier on the spread of technology. You know, Kyushu has been a very significant sort of connection point with the continent of Asia, right, with Korea and China through Korea. And so a lot of technological sort of influence did come through Kyushu, but because it was so far away from Kyoto, it didn't take root in sort of what we would consider the broader Japanese culture of the time. And so, you know, doing things like yuimono in Kyushu in the 11th century, things didn't really take hold up in sort of Kyoto or eventually in Edo until, say, maybe the 15th century. So there's a huge gap. Even though the technology was there, it just wasn't developing because of all of that going on, the conflicts and the distance and just the whole microcosm of sake reflects all of what was going on in Japan on a broader scale. And yeah, so I think the next step in the development is, as we said, the yuimono, the bound wooden vessels, which you see in everything from buckets all the way up to the massive brewing tanks. And essentially the technology that we're talking about is, if you've seen modern wooden brewing tanks, then you know what we're talking about, right? So you have these slatted tanks made with curved slats that are bound with woven bamboo cords. And honestly, I have been able to find no significant difference in the way that they are made, other than, you know, obviously, you know, tools are a bit more technologically advanced now. But even then, you know, they're still using planes and nata and hand tools to make these tanks. And of course, this is where I think Andy's insight comes in, because you happen to work at a brewery that has a workshop that makes wooden vessels.
Right? Yeah, Kembishi don't brew in kioke, wooden tanks. We'll call them kioke from now on. It's just easier. Yeah. But they do use a lot of wooden instruments. And I'm going to go out on a limb and say probably a lot more than your average brewery as well. For example, the koshki, the rice steamer, that is made of wood. The dake that they use, they are quite difficult to make as well. If you look at them, they're quite intricate, the design of them. So they use wooden dake for making yamahai, which obviously dake are a necessary piece of equipment. Inside the koshiki as well, you have a thing called a saru or a goma, the two names that you hear. This is a thing that kind of distributes steam. Nowadays, a lot of breweries have electronically controlled ones that you can actually adjust the pressure and things, but Kembishi use an old-fashioned wooden one. Most of the equipment inside the koji muro, and of course the koji trays that they use, the very small size ones, these are all made in-house in Kenbishi's woodworking facility. And that is really Kembishi in a nutshell. If they do have a very traditional focus, and in the past, of course, that is exactly how a brewery would have been set up. They had separate shokunin, so craftsmen, that would handle the vast demands of brewing equipment that were all made by wood. They would do repairs and they would make them from scratch, and this would have been an integral part of the brewery as a whole. These people, I think they called them taru shokunin. So it developed into its own industry that was supported and made possible, I guess, by the demand that was coming from the sake industry. So I just want to take a little step back, because it'll be a good lead-in to talking about what kind of influence that kioke had on the sake industry. But okay, Right now, if you have the money, you can buy sake that is made in kame. Obviously, nowadays it's extremely rare for brewers to do that. And really the fundamental reason is these things are very fragile. They're large, heavy, and breakable. So they're not ideal vessels for brewing in. But Yucho Shuzo, obviously, they do tend to like making traditional sake, and they're doing some wonderful work to revive these old techniques. They have a brand now called Mizuhana, and it comes in two varieties. There's Mizuhana 1355 and there's Mizuhana 1568. Now, that is a date, and it refers to a time where certain types of sake were prevalent. So the 1355 refers to the Goshu no Niki. This is one of the brewing manuals, but at the time you have recipes for things like Bodai Sen. But that first one, 1355, is made in a kame, and it is made in zero stage mashing. So that would have reflected these recipes that are available in the Goshu no Niki. So because of the size of them, obviously you just put in one addition, and it's still going to ferment, because they're relatively small compared to modern day brewing vessels. And that was a limit that brewers had. They couldn't make them any bigger than that, because they'd just be completely unstable. Then you get to the Tamoin no Niki. And as I said, there's a lot of brewing technology happens in these Buddhist temples. And one of them, which we didn't mention, is stage mashing, or Danjikomi as it's called. And so they've made that in a three-stage mash. They've also made it in winter, whereas the one before was made in summer, because again, that would have reflected how brewing happened back then. Before, they wouldn't have stopped brewing regardless of the season. And Bodai Sen was actually a summer method. By the Tamo and Noniki, they're starting to veer towards winter brewing, although it isn't exclusively winter brewing, and therefore they've done it in this three-stage mashing. But at that time, that would have just been on the cusp of the debut of Kyoke, and of course, fundamental changes in the way that sake is made, distributed, and consumed. This is going to be the next phase in our discussion tonight.
So, we're at this point where things are obviously changing, and we're going to be beating that drum again, the Edo period, right? So much changed, once Japan sort of got unified after the Sengoku period, and the Tokugawa government took hold. The country as a whole was able to start on this sort of developmental trajectory, and the sake industry was obviously not left behind. We've talked about how, particularly in the Nara region, a lot of what we consider to be modern sake took shape, right? We had the Kimoto development, which led into some great stability and safer brewing, and of course the sort of the sake that we loved. And it became a commodity that could be shipped to the government. What would you call it? The military government in Edo. We've talked many, many times about the concept of kudarizake, and all of this is deeply connected to this next stage in brewing tank development, right? Because they had to get bigger, is basically the story, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And a central part of this is Edo, or what is now Tokyo, obviously. This metropolis just springs out of nowhere. It's a sleepy little bay in the east of Japan with nothing going on. And then all of a sudden, the shogun, Tokugawa Ieyasu, makes this his base, the central focus of the country. But of course, there's no infrastructure. So everything before is all in the Kansai region, what they called Kamigata. So all the producers of sake and things, and not just sake, but foodstuffs in general, they've started in Nara and then it moves towards Setsu. They're all in this area that we now call modern day northern Osaka, Kobe, Hyogo region. That's where all the famous producers of these products are. So they have to figure out a way to get them in Edo. And that is where you have the demand for much more stable containers to move sake. But as the region itself starts to, obviously, the population skyrockets in Edo, then obviously there's your demand. So they need to obviously start upping production levels as well. And obviously making them in kame is just not going to cut it anymore. So there's your need for large scale brewing. And you sometimes hear historians talk about this period as sake's industrial revolution. That is what is about to begin when the Edo period begins in what 1600 or 1603, depending on which historian you
16.
speak to.
Yeah. I think it's pretty much settled at 1603 right now. But like we said, kame, they're heavy, they're fragile, they're limited in size, and that technology of yuimono, of the bound tanks already existed. People were aware of it, and I think the big thing here is, I think, financial, right? There was money to be made by greater production, so there was money to be made by developing the existing technology of Yuimono into something a bit bigger, and this is where we start to get those tanks. I really tried to find any kind of hard information on actual sizes, and the only sort of mentions that I could find was that the kame were basically limited to around 300 liters, Whereas, you know, the big tanks used in the Edo period reached 1800 liters. And I have no idea how grounded that is in reality, but it sounds reasonable, right? I do know that there are potters today who claim to be able to make up to a 900 liter tank. A kame of that size would be incredibly expensive, I think. It's very, very difficult to make large scale ceramic tanks. I think it would be very expensive to move them as well. They're quite heavy. So wood seems to be the natural choice for larger, easier to transport, easier to maintain, and more durable tanks, that, and both for brewing and for transport, right?
Yeah, I think I told you this story before, but I have experience with all of what we're going to talk about to some level. I've never brewed in kame, but the brewery that I worked at before, they have about two or three of these things, and there was discussions beginning about maybe one day using them, which I guess now when I think back, luckily it didn't happen, because I was given the task of just washing these things. They were sat outside and they'd got a bit dirty and they looked a bit feeling sorry for themselves. So we had to move these things about 15 meters across the other side of the yard to where we could get a hose to them and start washing them. And then we had to put them on their side. And just that simple operation, if you think doing that with a tank would have taken maybe 10 minutes, it took us about the best part of 3 hours, and about four of us kind of moving around and putting cardboard down and everything. It was terrifying. It's one of the most terrifying things I've ever done, because one of them was Bizen Yaki, and therefore it is valuable. So you can imagine it is just not practical to work with these things. In terms of what you're saying about the volume, I think the ones that we had were about 2 koku. So sure. So that's about 300. I've not seen any that would be as big as 3 koku, but I have heard that there are three koku was about the maximum. But to answer your question about kioke, they do actually get a lot bigger than that. If you go to Sawanotsuru, I think it is. Mm-hmm. These would have been developed later in the Edo period, but they have 35 koku, ooke they're called. So this is the kanji for big and tank. And they go up to about 35 koku, which is about 6,300 liters. So we are talking night and day in terms of size. This just wasn't like, oh, they could make slightly bigger tanks. It enabled larger scale brewing. This is brewing on an unprecedented scale.
Yeah. You know, and again, I do want to reiterate just the idea of moving something that big is just a whole other story, right? Even if it was possible to make a tank that big from pottery, it would just sit where it was. Like no one could ever get that from Okayama to Tokyo or anywhere, right? But these wooden tanks, you could break them down into slats, and you know, rebind them when they reach the place where they needed to be used. It's just a whole other ball game.
Yeah, and I've seen that being done. We actually dismantled one of our koshiki at Kenbishi, because we have two ogoshiki, they're called. These are big koshiki, and then they have a kogoshiki, which is a small one. And we're not going to use one of the bigger ones this year. So the guys that handle the woodworking, they just came in, about three or four of them, and they just stripped this thing down, and it felt like seconds. So they remove the binding, and then they take the slats out, and then they take the bottom, which is also slats. It makes a circular shape out of the slats. And the thing was dismantled within minutes. So they were very practical. It was a great step forward.
Yeah. So just a better thing all around. Now, so one of the interesting things about wood that I think is going to be maybe part of a conversation that we also have later, but you know, a big difference between pottery, even sort of unglazed pottery like in Bizen and wood, is that wood is obviously much more porous, and it becomes home to all those microorganisms that are so both essential and dangerous to sake brewing. And so the sake not only is being made in much greater proportion, in much greater sort of in a very different kind of sort of style, but also the sake itself is going to be influenced by that. It's going to be influenced by the colonies of microorganisms living in the wood. It's also going to be influenced by the wood itself, which is, I think, one of the things that happens particularly with transportation in those wooden kegs, the taru, up to Tokyo, is the wood influences the flavor and aroma of sake, and some people quite like that. Kiga is the word for it. Kiga literally means wood smell, wood aroma, and that becomes part of the sake experience. And so wood becomes an influence, whereas we don't know if pottery was an influence. There's a potential for it. We do know that storing, for example, spirits like awamori in particular, there's been scientific research done that shows there is an actual sort of reaction that happens. Sort of minerals in the clay act as catalysts for changes that happen in the spirit, and there's no reason to think that clay would not influence sake. It's not an inert substance. There are minerals that are directly exposed to the sake, but sadly we just don't know how brewing and storing sake in clay changes it. But we do know that wood influences sake in a fundamental way.
Yeah, there is a few breweries that have done this, and there's one that actively still does this. I'll need to look up the name and post it on our Instagram or something. But there's a brewery in Okayama that ages sake in bizen yaki, and I've tried it. It tastes very matured for sake. It has that kind of jukseishu profile to it, but they claim that by doing it that way, it ages the sake in a very different way than if they were to age the sake in say an enamel tank, which is going to be the last part of this discussion. But my personal opinion on or observation of what it could be, my own experience, by the little experience I have of using kiyoke, they were brilliant for heat retention. Mm-hmm. So there were obviously a lot of downsides to kiyoke, the things that you mentioned, but one of the upsides for them for fermentation was they really did have very good heat retention compared to modern tanks, enamel tanks and stainless steel tanks. And I always wondered if that would be the same with earthenware vessels, because if you think about when you drink warm sake, the best cup, that's why you don't drink warm sake from a glass, for example, because it's got really bad heat retention. Whereas the ideal vessel for that is a thick piece of earthenware, because it retains the heat of it. So I wonder if you're aging sake and things, it would just have a little bit more consistency to the temperature.
Oh, the temperature. Okay.
Done in that way.
That makes sense. It absolutely makes sense. And there's going to be other things as well. There's, I think there's going to be a different, not necessarily direct, but more access to oxygen. Even really highly fired pottery is slightly porous. There's going to be influences with the clay itself, and heat retention absolutely is going to be, it's much more, I think, insulating than glass would be. So obviously, I think wood is it. Wood is the only choice for a very large portion of sake's brewing history, right, all the way through the Edo period. And Andy, I think, has already mentioned the next step, and the next step is enamel. Now, I don't know, I could not find a specific kind of turning point for when enamel became the sort of dominant tank style. All I learned was sort of the Meiji period, which makes sense, right? Because the Meiji period is when they really started bringing a lot of that scientific research and information and thinking about things like hygiene in ways that they weren't doing during the Edo period. So, you know, the Meiji period, 1868 and on. All that I could find was that the government encouraged the adoption of enamel tanks for hygiene reasons. Do you have anything more specific than that?
Well, yeah, definitely the Meiji period is when these enamel tanks are introduced. But like a lot of things in the sake industry, if you think of how long it took for Sokujo, for example, from its introduction to become widespread, from the source that I found, it was a very similar situation with enamel tanks. In fact, one of the sources I found, they said that it was about 10 years after the war where Kyoke finally got completely phased out, that
Okay.
this was the transition period or the widespread transition period into enamel tanks. So although they come in the Meiji period, like a lot of things, it takes a while for brewers to, because you're not just going to suddenly, oh, there's this new piece of
Oh, yeah.
technology, okay, rip out all of the brewing know-how that we've known for several hundred years and then introduce these other ones. You can't do that with brewing. You have to first of all study the effect that it's going to have on your product, and then do trials, and then see if it is for you. And we take it for granted now that enamel tanks would have been great, but I guarantee you there would have been skepticism. There would have been master brewers that were not interested in using them, that flat out refused to use them. There is nowadays. So
Yeah.
there's still master brewers nowadays that, where they can, they only brew from Kyoke. So yeah, according to that source, it's actually after the war where this next stage of these modern tanks come into widespread use.
What I find interesting about it, though, is that the actual technology, right, enamel, is not new. Like it's ancient. Like people, you know, have been fusing these sort of glassy porcelain cover to metal for thousands of years. Like it goes back to like Mykonos, and you know, China was making enamelware a long time ago. So I think probably the advancements came in sort of the industrial usage of it, right? So it moved from sort of a creative and artistic thing into industrial usage. And so this is one of those points where I feel almost let down in with myself that I could not for the life of me find out when that industrial process really took hold. I couldn't find out, was it cheaper than wood at first? Obviously, it's cheaper now because, you know, wooden tanks are a very, very unusual commodity. There's only a few people who can make them. That just naturally drives the price up. So I apologize for my lack of data on the enamel stage, but what I do know is this is essentially it's just more hygienic, and you know, we don't have that danger of unwanted bacteria taking root in wood. Wood is much harder to sterilize, or I don't know if sterilize is the correct word, but to disinfect than enamel, obviously. Enamel is much more sort of robust towards things like, you know, soaps and boiling water.
Yeah, well, from a brewer's perspective, that is it. That would be it. I don't have a solid source as well, but having worked with both of them, we talked about what was bad about earthenware. So let's be fair and do the same for Kyoke. As much as I love them, they were a constant headache to work with, and really, it does come down to just general maintenance of them. You know, brewers, obviously, we brew for about half the year. The other half, the brewery sits dormant. You can't just bring these things out, give them a quick wash, and start putting ingredients in them and start making sake. They have to be prepped. In the olden days, in the Edo period, they would put these things outside to gain some moisture. Then they would fill them up with water. Then the wood would expand. If not, they were just completely porous. And yet you had to repeat this process of filling them up with usually hot water about three, four times before they were actually watertight, because obviously the wood shrinks over the summer as it gets dehydrated. They're very difficult to clean. Obviously, a lot of breweries now, they will use, they call it senzai in Japanese. It's that kind of liquid soap that they use in a sponge. You can't do that with wood, obviously. You have to do it with just hot water and essentially like a Brillo pad, a very unabrasive kind of Brillo pad, and that takes any dirt or sometimes mold, if I'm being honest, off of them. So that's the difficulties, and that for me would be what the appeal of enamel tanks are. They're extremely easy to clean. You don't have to do any maintenance to them other than covering them up in the summer and then taking the cover off again in the winter before you use them. Give them a clean, maybe pour some boiling water over them to sterilize them. They're ready to go. So that seems not much of a big deal, but to brewers that are pushed for time and spaces at a premium inside a brewery, so you have a lot. I have to have a quick turnaround on the tanks, and being able to clean them so easily is just a massive deal for brewers.
Yeah, it's I mean, it makes a lot of sense, you know, and it is funny to me now that there is a distinct, not perhaps large, but a distinct movement of breweries that are sort of trying to go back to wooden tanks. And I appreciate that, you know, I drink some wood tank sake and I enjoy it as well, but just sort of thinking about it from just a purely practical viewpoint, man. That's a heck of a choice to make. Just, yeah.
Yeah, well, both me and you have. I almost feel guilty mentioning Gokyo again, but
It's hard not to.
yeah. I mean, what can I say? They try so many different things. It's hard not to reference them, you know, with the kind of topics that we bring up. But Gokyo, we went together. I know you've been several times, Jim, but they have a separate Kiyoke brewery to their enamel tank brewery, and you could tell from the Toji that we spoke to that the Kiyoke one is the one that gives him headache, but that is his passion. So it was a labor of love. But you saw the riggings that they had to do, and you know, you speak to the brewers about how they have to clean them and make sure that they don't get infected with things. And yeah, it's just a whole different school of brewing. But so many people talk about the benefits of Kiyoke as well that enamel tanks can't give you. But maybe we've talked enough about Kiyoke. So far we've talked about how they affected the landscape of the brewery for each one. I think it would be good to talk about what benefits and what possibilities enamel tanks have provided for the sake industry.
Right. So I think there's just I think the kinds of advantages that any major I guess standard industrial product can bring, right? You know, it with enamel tanks, you don't need a craftsman who comes and maintains, and you just order them from a company and they show up, and if you need a new one, then you just buy a new one, and they're obviously going to at scale they become cheaper, and they become as an industrial process, sake brewing benefits from ease of adoption, ease of maintenance, and all of those different things. And you can get much, 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 much bigger. Oh man, enormous, enormous enamel tanks I've seen. Like, you know, just I don't even remember, 20,000 liters.
Keep going, Jim. I'm gonna
Yeah,
talk. I'm gonna trump
I
you
was
there, I'm afraid.
trying to remember the biggest one I've ever seen. Like, it was bigger than a house.
Yeah, so from the ones that I've worked with pretty much exclusively, even at Kenbishi, I've worked with small batch fermentation. Kenbishi is the biggest, but it's still only 3,000 or 3 tons of white rice is the baseline for the recipe. But for storage, yeah, these things can get incredible. So the largest ones that I've seen are 36,000 liters. They're for storage specifically. You can't get even close to that with Kiyoke. So this kind of modern, real large scale brewing by a modern in a modern sense is only possible with these new generation of tanks.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we're in the modern period, and obviously enamel is not the only thing, but I think the differences between enamel those sort of those basic enamel tanks, and the other modern variations are not quite, they're just not that big, right? Stainless steel and enamel, like they basically have the same benefits, except I think stainless steel is probably just going to be a simpler manufacturing process, which makes them probably a little bit cheaper. You know, you don't have to coat them with that that sort of glassy porcelain layer of enamel. But I don't know, like
that is actually a big deal. If you're, when you're working with these enamel tanks, they're obviously, they're not indestructible. Like you just said, it's iron coated with glass. If you drop something into the tank, if you hit the bottom of the tank with a kaibo too hard, I mean, if you do a brewery tour in the summer and you see a lineup of empty tanks, look inside some of them, you're likely to see patches that have been put over where that enamel has broken off. That is their downside to enamel tanks that you don't get with stainless steel ones. The stainless steel ones can take a big impact, and even when they're impacted, it isn't going to have a detrimental effect to brewing with them. Whereas the enamel tanks, once you get through that enamel surface and you get into the iron, then they can rust and they can discolor the sake and they can lead to all kinds of bad things. So the enamel tanks aren't indestructible, whereas the stainless steel ones are as good as. So again, it's more about them being a safety element, I guess, of that you can bump them and knock them and not have to worry about them too much.
Yeah, I mean, that being said, people still use enamel all the time. They're still all over the place, and so, you know, it's sort of, I guess, more an iteration on this modern, clean, durable style of tank. And I think that's probably where we get into, I guess, the technological attachments to tanks, right? Because then, you know, once we're into this modern period of metal tanks, then Andy mentioned, heat retention, temperature control, things like that become a little bit more of an issue, right? Because metal is extremely conductive to heat. It just sort of will leach all of the temperature out. Your ambient temperature becomes your brewing temperature immediately. And so I think modern iterations of technological additions to tanks, things like temperature control, are a direct result of the use of metal.
Yeah, if you look at what's going on at the time where these enamel tanks are starting to get used, you've got things like Sokujo being developed. You've got new strands of yeast that are coming in that start to get increasingly more aromatic, or being capable of producing more aromatics. So the sake industry at this time has just been given the equipment that is going to be conducive to this modern style of sake, which requires temperature control. And that is something that you're very limited to with Kyoke, and you're completely at the mercy of Mother Nature with earthenware. So there's your three stages of development. Without these stainless steel enamel tanks, and of course, to go even further to the most modern ones, these thermal tanks, which literally have refrigeration, and you can, you know, you can press a button and you can maintain that temperature inside the tank, then these are all tools that brewers are able to use, and they would not be able to make ginjo the way that they make ginjo nowadays without these tanks. It just wouldn't be feasible. So we've talked about how they shaped the industry. These have made a perfect environment for this modern style of sake that requires a lot of intervention from the brewers.
Yeah. All right. And, you know, I think that's pretty much our takeaway, right? We've talked about these three developments in the vessels used to brew and store and transport sake, and how that sort of interaction between, you know, the market and the brewing industry resulted in this technology that then went on to shape the kind of sake that people were making and drinking. So, all right, that brings us, I think, to the big point, our recommendations, Andrew. I'll let you go first, because this was another tricky one for me, and I'm wondering if we might overlap, but let's go for it. What's your recommendation this time, Andy?
Okay, I hope not. That would be a bit of an anticlimax, but I'm gonna go with a brewery that I've actually mentioned a few times before, so this is becoming a bit of a pattern. You might be able to moan at me as I do at you about Gokyo, but I'm going to go with Kikumasamune and their Taru Sake or Taru Sake. This is not the Junmai one. I'm going to go for the Aruten one. There is a difference. The Junmai one, if you're wondering, is in a normal Yongo bean bottle, whereas the one that I'm talking about is only in either one cup or a kami cup, as they're called. So it's a paper carton. But the reason I've went for that one, I think it is the Aruten that does it for me. First of all, it's Kimoto. They make them in Yoshino cedar barrels. I think I heard from the brewery they spend about 2 to 3 weeks in there, so it's not actually a very long time, but it's just enough to give it a lovely mild aroma. But I guess the Aruten gives it that light crispness, so it is a dry sake as well, and all those flavors just come together. It's one of few sake that I would describe as quite refreshing. I don't know, maybe it's just me. I love drinking them outside. To me, it's in that Gokyo mold as well of their one cup, that it's just a nice, refreshing Aruten style of sake, and it works great for drinking outside. So if you're in Japan, this is good consumer advice as well. You can pick one up at virtually any convenience store in and around Osaka, Kobe, the Kansai region. They're up.
Yamaguchi, it's
Probably everywhere in Japan. I'm being Sorry, I don't get out much, Jim, not like you. So you can pick them up for about 200 yen. That's what, I don't know, $2 or something like that. And yeah, it's just a lovely little drink and a great way to try proper made taru sake. If you are in Nada, you can also go to the museum and they have the Taru Sake Meister Factory, where you can actually, if you book a tour, you can go in and it shows you their separate department for woodworking and making just vast quantities that are required to just make this one particular brand of sake. So give it a
Fantastic.
try.
Yeah, I'm glad you picked one that I have actually tried and that I did not even think about on this time. So I'm going a completely other direction. Andy went for a readily available sake. I'm going for a much less readily available sake. I'm going for Aramasa, another brewery that is, I think, well known for its use of wood. And the one that I am choosing is Cosmos,
Oh,
the
good
sort of
choice. Good choice.
the pink label. Yes, it is a Kyoke brewed. I'm assuming Junmai Ginjo. They don't really label it, but that way. But it's just it's got this interesting sort of balance of that very sort of modernness about it, with that really nice robust wood brewed flavor that Aramasa, I think, does really, really well. I'm just in general, I don't drink a lot of Aramasa, but when I get a chance to drink some Cosmos, I always take it because it's really one that I enjoy. So, that's my recommendation.
Great choice, but I have
Thank
to
you.
give you a little bit of bad news. I have actually recommended that very sake in a previous episode. So
Oh
you're
no.
stepping on my toes slightly, but we'll let you
All
off
right.
because it is so
Okay.
good. I
It
recommended it
is.
for Hire, something really obscure.
Oh, there you go.
But I think anyway, our listeners
Sorry.
can correct us on that. But it is fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, it was either that or Gokyo, and I'm pretty sure I've recommended the Gokyo Kyoke Junmai before, so
Don't worry, I'll edit that bit out about Gokyo.
fair enough. All right. So that brings us to the end of another sake deep dive. Thank you so much for listening. Just so everybody knows, we do have a Patreon. Our Patreon is at patreon.com/sake deep dive. We are eternally grateful for all of the support that we are receiving. Thank you so much. It's really it does make doing this a lot easier. We don't talk about it a lot, but it's not easy to keep this up every month, especially, Andy's in the brewing season. So yeah. We really do appreciate it. I have, as always, been your host, Jim Ryan. I am a sake writer and translator and a doer of other things. You can find me online at my website, www.jimryan.com. That's JIMRYAN.com. rion.com. Andrew?
As usual, you get me on my website, www.originsaki.com, and it has links to my Instagram page from there as well. But it's just as easy to, if you do need to get in touch, just to send me an email from the website.
All right. So, everybody, keep your tokuri heated and your guinomi filled. Drink responsibly and kanpai.
Kanpai.